Hey guys, you can imagine how happy I am right now to be back again recording new episodes. As you know, if you follow me on social media, I couldn't publish new episodes because I wasn't in Barcelona due to the coronavirus outbreak. But now I'm back home, so this month I will publish 2 new episodes as I always do. And I've had time to write many more. The second thing that I wanted to comment is that I'm doing my final year project for my college on how a social media plan can help improve brand awareness and podcast downloads. So I'm going to be very active this month on social media to test a bunch of things and see whether they work or not to gain more followers and subscribers. I have planned different content for the different platforms I'm in. For instance, I have already published a presentation summarizing everything about Visigothica Spain in 120 slides for a SlideShare. And I have prepared exclusive articles for LinkedIn and Medium.com. Another thing I have recently started is a new section on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook and Pinterest called Unknown Spain. And what I do is publish every 2 weeks, 5 posts each workday about a particular town or region of Spain that I consider a hidden gem. I think it will be useful for those of you who want to travel to Spain, whenever it's possible, to have some ideas about places to go that are not the most popular and touristic spots. And as a matter of fact, I will convert this social media post into blog post too. You will also see this month quotes and clips from the episodes, quotes from Spanish historical figures, inspirational Spanish sayings, memes, photos of popular spots, festivities that in a normal year will have taken place this month, the daily on this day section, posts about books and merchandising available on thehistoryofspain.com/store, and I have prepared quizzes to challenge your knowledge. Another last piece of content that's worth to comment is a new section for YouTube and Facebook called Churros Chat, where I will talk in a short video about anything related to Spain, the podcast, or just about me, all while eating churros. So Churros Chat will be a casual format to also answer some of your questions. And in fact, I plan to make a live Q&A on YouTube, Facebook and Instagram at the end of May. So please, consider following the History of Spain podcast in some social networks. The podcast is on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Reddit, and I have recently added Pinterest, Medium and LinkedIn. Please enjoy the content I will publish there, and with that said, let's just start with the show. I'm David Cott, host of the History of Spain podcast, and this is episode 35 called Christians versus Muladis. In this episode you will learn about the conflicts between the northern Christians and the Muladis of the Upper March and the end of the Arista dynasty of Pamplona. Don't miss an episode, subscribe to the podcast. Okay, since the last episode was published almost 2 months ago due to the coronavirus outbreak, I think all of you will find a recap helpful. 2 episodes ago, in episode 33, Muladis in Revolt, I explained how the Andalusian society was changing around the mid-9th century to become more Arabicized and Islamized. Related to this cultural and religious phenomena, there was another phenomenon more worrisome for the Umayyads of Córdoba. The Muladis, the Hispanogots who converted to Islam didn't like to see how they were discriminated after they made the effort to convert to Islam and adopt a new culture. And that's one of the many reasons why some Muradis started important revolts that undermined Umayyad authority throughout Al-Andalus. On the other hand, in episode 34, County of Castile and Portugal, we saw how Ordoño I and Alfonso III of Asturias made a huge progress to advance south by conquering and repopulating the Duero Valley. This is when León was repopulated, the counties of Castile, Álava, Portugal and Coimbra were founded, and the Reconquista ideology was developed. All these events were important for later developments in Spanish medieval history. So with that said, let me introduce you to today's episode. In this episode, Christians versus Muradis, we are going to discover many different things about the Kingdom of Asturias, Pamplona, the counties of Castile, Aragon, Ribagorza and Pallars, and the Muslim warlords of the Upper March. So I'm going to mix very different narratives, as it's impossible not to do so because events are very interconnected. However, the most important idea that you should take away from this episode is that the emergence and rise of new lords and powers in the north and in Al-Andalus was only made possible by the collapse of Umayyad authority outside of Córdoba on one hand and the collapse of the Carolingian Empire on the other. In the next episode, I will talk about the birth of Catalonia that was part of the process of disintegration of Carolingian power. Let me begin by introducing the main characters of today's episode, because I'm going to refer to them frequently. We have King Alfonso III, who greatly expanded the Kingdom of Asturias up to the Duero River. Then the two last caudillos of Pamplona and the first true king of Pamplona, García Íñiguez and Fortún Garcés of the Arista dynasty, and Sancho Garcés of the Jimena dynasty. Then we have three important Muslim warlords of Muradi origin in the Upper March, Muhammad ibn Lup and Lup ibn Muhammad of the Banu Qasi clan, and Muhammad al-Tawil of Huesca. The Banu Qasi fought the Banu Tuhib and Banu al-Tawil for the hegemony of the Upper March, while conflicts with their Christian neighbors continued, and sometimes with Córdoba too. In the second half of the 9th century, there were three emirs in Córdoba. Muhammad I, one of the leading figures of the previous episode, and then al-Mundir, who ruled only for 2 years, and Abdallah, who ruled Córdoba and the nearby areas. As secondary characters, we have Count Diego Rodríguez of Castile, son and successor of Count Rodrigo, Aznar Galíndez II, and Galíndez Aznárez II of the then small county of Aragon, and Ramón I of the counties of Ribagorza and Pallars, between Aragon and Old Catalonia. These are the main characters in this episode, so let's start by finding out about the Kingdom of Asturias and the County of Castile. The defeats that Emir Muhammad I suffered at the hands of Alfonso III forced him to sue for peace in 884, being the first time an Umayyad ruler had done so in relation to the Christian kings. The Emir gave the remains of the Mozarab martyrs Eulogio and Leocricia, a woman who was executed along the instigator of the movement of the martyrs of Córdoba. It was truly a humiliation, and a clear indication that Córdoba was losing control and hegemony over Al-Andalus and the other powers of the Iberian Peninsula. In fact, it wasn't until 916 that an Umayyad ruler launched again an Atayfa, a summer raid, against the Christian north. And in the meantime, only the Muslim lords of the borderlands engaged in war against them for their own self-interests. The truce with Córdoba allowed Alfonso III to fortify and consolidate the lands he had recently conquered between the Cantabrian Mountains and the Duero River, and to progress and repopulate the lands of the Meseta south of León. Moreover, three of Alfonso's brothers revolted around that time. So peace with Córdoba allowed the Asturian king to suppress the revolt, and he later had his brothers blinded. Alfonso the Great decided to focus on domestic policy and repopulation instead of supporting, for instance, the revolt of Umar ibn Hafsun. Probably because at that time it wasn't yet a major threat to Umayyad authority. The lack of support from other Muslim rebels may also have to do with the fact that relations with the Muladi rebel Ibn Marwan had soured, because Alfonso III had massacred some Muslims of a castle near Badajoz, and Ibn Marwan had also reconciled with the Emir Muhammad. Having reached peace with Córdoba, Alfonso III was able to colonize new lands south of León, mainly with Mozarabs who had fled Al-Andalus. It's likely that the king of Asturias made a call to attract settlers from all over Spain, promising them lands, religious freedom, and protection. Alfonso ordered the repopulation of Simancas, Toro, and Zamora in the 890s, and the latter became the southernmost outpost of the Leonese part of the Kingdom of Asturias, built along the Duero River. Apart from these official repopulations, there were other villages repopulated through the private initiative of peasants and monks. As I have explained in other episodes, this kind of colonization was based on presura, the principle of a squatter's rights that recognized the ownership of a land by whoever occupied a previously unoccupied land. That's how the region known as Tierra de Campos or Gothic Plains was colonized. And the same is true for many villages of northern Portugal. In the county of Castile, the son of Rodrigo, Diego Rodríguez, succeeded his father in 873. He scored some victories and suffered defeats against Muhammad ibn Lub of the Banu Qasi. But the most important event of Diego's rule was the foundation of Burgos in 884. Burgos then became the southernmost outpost in Castile, along with the castle of Castrojeriz that was reconstructed by Muño Núñez, grandson of the count of the same name, who conceded the municipal charter or Carta Puebla of Prañosera in 828. These outposts are even farther south of the defile of Pancorbo, the doors of Castile, from where the Muslim warlords attacked Castile and Álava. The foundation of Burgos and Castrojeriz were indeed very bold and risky decisions, because there was a substantial number of Muslim settlements in La Rioja, which was only a day's ride away on horseback. The foundation of Burgos is also very remarkable because it eventually became the capital and most important city of the county of Castile, nicknamed the Cabeza de Castilla or Head of Castile, although initially Burgos was just another border outpost. Later, in 885, Count Diego Rodríguez was killed, probably in a battle against Muhammad ibn Lub. Although some historians speculate that Diego may have supported Alfonso's rebel brothers. They argue that this will explain why the county of Castile was divided after the death of Diego. However, Gonzalo Martínez Díez, author of El Condado de Castilla, La Historia Frente a la Leyenda, argues that a more likely explanation is that Diego Rodríguez didn't have an adult son capable of ruling a key borderland like Castile. The fact is that there are very few historical records that detail events in Castile between 885 and 899, except for a few charters that don't refer to a Count of Castile. Muño Núñez, who had repopulated Castrojeriz a few years before, is cited as the Count of Castile between 899 and 912. But there are also other counties that suddenly appear and that used to be under Castile. These counties are Amaya, Lantarón, Cerezo, and Burgos. And they weren't reunited by the Count of Castile until 931. Moving on to Pamplona, in episode 33, Muladis in Revolt, I briefly mention how after the second battle of Albelda, the Cordoban forces attacked Pamplona and captured the Pamplonese heir, Fortun Garcés. Fortun Garcés, nicknamed the One-Eyed, spent the next 20 years of his life living in Córdoba. Not in a prison, though. He was well-treated during his stay. But he couldn't go back to Pamplona until his father García Íñiguez died in 882. Fortun wasn't the only captive of the Arista dynasty. His daughter, Óneca Fortúnez, was held with him in Córdoba. The then 14-year-old Basque princess is known for marrying a member of the Umayyad dynasty, Abdallah, who became emir in 888 following the death of Al-Mundir. This is how Oneka became the grandmother of the Caliph of Córdoba Abderrahman III. And as I explained in episode 25, Emirate of Córdoba and Abderrahman, this is an example of sex as a symbol of power. As a result of all the intermarriages since the time of Abderrahman I, the Arab identity of the Umayyads of Córdoba is a great example of how race can be, or is, a social construct. Because there was very little Arab blood running through Abderrahman III's veins. Later, in 882, Oneka returned to Pamplona along with her father. And she married a Basque count. And as a result of that marriage, she became an ancestor of the current king, Felipe VI of Spain. And what happened in Pamplona after Fortun Garcés was captured? Well, not much is known about the next 40 or 45 years, and we have contradictory interpretations of what happened. According to some historians, such as José Lacarra, the caudillo García Íñiguez continued to play a role in the Upper March by re-establishing the alliance with the Banu Qasi. In this case, through four sons of Musa ibn Musa, who coordinated the seizures of Tudela, Huesca, Zaragoza and Monzón. With the help of the Banu Tuhib, Emir Muhammad was able to reoccupy Huesca and ravage Pamplona, so the success of the Banu Qasi proved short-lived. The Arab Iran, Al-Mundir, launched campaigns against the strongholds of the Banu Qasi and Pamplona. But with the chaotic situation in Al-Andalus and the campaigns of Alfonso III, Córdoba was unable to launch new raids. According to this version of the story, in 881 or 882, García Íñiguez died and Fortun Garcés returned. However, based on some Arabic sources, Levi Provençal, a A French historian gives a different version and interpretation about what happened before and after this little-known period. The Rista dynasty couldn't have started to rule Pamplona in the first place if it wasn't for the support of another great Basque family, the Jimenos, also called Jimenez or Jimena dynasty. According to Levi Provençal, after the sons of Viking Ragnar Lodbrok captured the caudillo Pamplona, García Íñiguez, the Jimenez dynasty ruled in his absence. The large sum needed to free Íñiguez came not only from the Aristas, but also from the Jimenos and probably the Asturians too. Because of this incident, the Jimenos had enough influence to change the foreign policy of Pamplona and form an alliance with the Kingdom of Asturias, as they didn't have kinship ties with any Muladi family. On the contrary, the Jimenos sealed marriages with the ruling Asturian dynasty, which was key to later remove the Aristas from power in 905. Íñiguez may have died in 860 or 870 instead of 882. And if that was the case, the Basque leader García Jiménez acted as regent of Pamplona instead of Fortún Garcés, who was still captive in Córdoba. The weak foundations of the Aristas and the fact that Frankish chronicles give the Aristas and Jimenos the same rank reinforces the idea that the so-called Kingdom of Pamplona of the 9th century was not yet a kingdom. Obviously, the Umayyads didn't like to see a united and a stronger north. And within this context, we can understand why the Andalusis were unable to launch more raids. When Fortún Garcés returned, Cordoban troops accompanied him, and the marriage ties with the Umayyads forced the Aristas to accept their position of vassals of Córdoba. The Jimenos were still loyal to the Aristas, and there were marriages between the two houses. However, Fortún was already an old man, and so lacked the vitality and energy and military skills needed to defend attacks from some members of the Banu Qasi, Muhammad ibn Lup, and later his son Lup ibn Muhammad. Muhammad ibn Lup tried to restore the former glory of the clan by first serving the emir in the suppression of a revolt of another member of the Banu Qasi clan. This event happened in the context of a major and disastrous Cordoban offensive to liberate the Hajib, or prime minister, Hashim ibn Abdelaziz, who had been captured by the Muladi rebel of Badajoz ibn Marwan and handed over to Alfonso III. The apparent loyalty of Muhammad towards the emir allowed him to reunite the Banu Qasi under his leadership and gain control over several strongholds of the Upper March. From then on, Muhammad ibn Lup remained relatively loyal to the emir, and he fortified the frontier with the Kingdom of Asturias of Alfonso III and the Kingdom of Pamplona. The Banu Qasi then ravaged Castile, Álava and Pamplona several times, and both Emir al-Mundir and Abdallah recognized the authority of Muhammad ibn Lup, mainly because they couldn't impose direct rule. Muhammad was trying to emulate his grandfather Musa ibn Musa by controlling several fortresses including Garnedo, Tudela, Nájera or Lleida in present-day Catalonia. However, the ambition of the new patriarch of the Banu Qasi became clear when he briefly gained control over Toledo in the Middle March, where the Banu Qasi had to compete with the Berber Banu Dilnun. The fame and power of Muhammad ibn Lup earned him powerful enemies, and the governor of Zaragoza of the Banu Tuhib clan conspired to have him killed in 898. His head was displayed for 8 days in the palace of the Umayyads of Cordoba, as a reminder of what happens to traitors and to show that the Umayyads were still powerful. Even though, at that time, this wasn't really the case. However, the Banu Qasi would still cause trouble to Cordoba and the Christian kingdoms for a few more years. The son of Muhammad, Lub ibn Muhammad, proved to be a worthy successor. Alfonso III of Asturias and Fortun Garcés of Pamplona joined forces and entered Banu Qasi territory, but they suffered a crushing defeat at Borja, near Tudela and Zaragoza. He was also successful raiding Álava and the counties of Ribagorza and Pallars of Ramon I. And that earned him enough prestige to convince the Toledans that Lub ibn Muhammad and the Banu Qasi were strong enough to rule them again. Nonetheless, as I said in the beginning of the episode, there was a strong competition in the upper march for hegemony, and other Muslim clans fought the Banu Qasi bitterly. Notably, the Arab Banu Tuhib and an emerging Muladi family, the Banu Altawil of Huesca and Barbastro, who bordered the county of Aragon. Lub ibn Muhammad again defeated Alfonso III of Asturias and Ramon I of Ribagorza Pallars in 904. And the successes of the Banu Qasi over the Asturians prompted Fortun Garcés of Pamplona to restore the alliance with the Muladi clan. Because of that, the Kingdom of Asturias, with the support of Ramon of Ribagorza Pallars, planned a coup led by Sancho Garcés of the Jimena dynasty to overthrow the Aristas in 905. It's possible that, in a change, the Jimenos recognized the Asturian pretension of hegemony over the other Christians of the Iberian Peninsula. At least, theoretically. The dynastic change seems to have been peaceful, because the Aristas and Jimenos already had kinship ties, and King Fortun Garcés was very old. Although, if there was military resistance, it didn't last long. This is how the Kingdom of Pamplona was constituted and consolidated, because, as I explained in episode 29, Kingdom of Pamplona and County of Aragon, the Kingdom of Pamplona of the Aristas was ruled by a caudillo with weak institutions and a ruler that wasn't much more powerful than other Basque lords. Therefore, the dynasty that continued to rule Pamplona and then Navarre until the 11th century started with Sancho Garcés, the first true king of Pamplona. While this dynastic transition was happening in Pamplona, the Toledans assassinated their Banu Qasi governor and removed the influence of the Muladi clan with the aid of the Banu Dilnun and the Asturians. Things started to look bad for the Banu Qasi, and Lub ibn Muhammad decided to attack Pamplona to restore his influence there. Unfortunately for him, he fell into an ambush, and King Sancho Garcés killed him. This early military success was very important in confirming the legitimacy of Sancho Garcés' rule over Pamplona. After that, the Banu Qasi still held out against the Pamplonese and Asturian advances in the region of La Rioja for some years. However, the power of the Banu Qasi clan quickly faded away, and they disappeared completely from history in 924, when the remaining members split and some moved to the Cordoba of Abderrahman III, while others moved to the Christian north. We cannot speak about what was going on in the Pyrenean area without mentioning the county of Aragon. As discussed in previous episodes, the County of Aragon was a vassal state of the Kingdom of Pamplona. And during this tumultuous period, there are two counts that should be mentioned. One is Count Aznar Galíndez II, ruled Aragon from 867 until his death in 893. This Count of Aragon was married to a daughter of the Caudillo of Pamplona, García Íñiguez. And their daughter later married Muhammad Altawil, the Muladi governor of Huesca, in the area that bordered Aragon to the south. Muhammad Altawil was yet another Muladi rebel who competed for the hegemony of the Upper March. The Banu Qasi defeated him several times, although before Lupi bin Muhammad died, Altawil managed to conquer the stronghold of Barbastro. Muhammad Altawil was more successful against Ramon I of Ribagorza and Pallars, and attacking his own brother-in-law, Galindo Aznárez II of Aragon. Altawil attempted to attack the Pamplona of Sancho Garcés I, but he was defeated, and he also attacked Barcelona in 913, resulting in his death in battle. As for Count Galindo Aznárez II of Aragon, one of his daughters married the son of Ramon I, and more importantly, another daughter married García Sánchez I of Pamplona, the heir of Sancho Garcés. Because of this marriage, after the death of Galindo Aznárez II in 922, the County of Aragon became fully integrated into the Kingdom of Pamplona until it regained independence in 1035. To the east of the County of Aragon and west of the Spanish March were the counties of Ribagorza and Pallars. This region consisted in a number of small valleys descending from the Pyrenees, which were at first administered directly by the Frankish counts of Toulouse. Nonetheless, all that changed when a son of Bernardo of Septimania killed the Count of Toulouse and usurped the county in 872. This instability allowed Count Ramon to gain independence from Toulouse and the Carolingian Empire. To stabilize his domains, he had to seek alliances and marriages with the Jimenos of Pamplona and the Banu Qasi. Another of those links across religious divides that are common in the Pyrenees of this period. Although later Lupi bin Muhammad and Muhammad Altawil successfully raided and ravaged his counties. Nonetheless, the most interesting thing about Count Ramon is the constitution of a new bishopric, independent from the archdioceses of Urgell and Narbonne. In a sense, this is similar to how Alfonso II challenged the primacy of the Episcopal See of Toledo, then under the Emirate of Córdoba, by claiming to have the remains of the Apostle Santiago in Santiago de Compostela. The independence of the national ecclesiastical authorities was therefore as important as the political independence of a state. The newly established bishopric was that of Roda. And it's quite interesting because that's the reason why Roda de Isàvena, a municipality with now only 40 inhabitants, has the spectacular Cathedral of St. Vincent, a very impressive display of cultural heritage. Just before his death in 920, Ramon divided the ownership of the counties of Ribagorza and Pallars in two among his four sons, and these two counties remained independent until they were absorbed by the Kingdom of Aragon 1 century and 3 centuries after their independence. With the time we have left, I would like to briefly discuss some economic aspects of the Kingdom of Asturias. The main idea is that the economy of the Kingdom of Asturias was a closed economy, based on the exploitation of the land and with very little trade. In that sense, it wasn't different from the economy of the Visigothic Kingdom, or in fact the majority of economies of this time. Trade was restricted to essential goods that couldn't be easily found, like salt or spices. And this economic self-sufficiency meant that each region had to produce almost everything that consumed, including food, clothes, or tools. The circulation of currency continued the trend seen in the Visigothic Kingdom, and currencies almost disappeared. Asturian kings never created new mines. And because of that, products were traded based on a primitive barter system. Agriculture followed the rudimentary techniques of antiquity, with two-field and three-field systems and a lack of manure and fertilizers. While fields were privately exploited, pastures and forests were communal. On the other hand, animal husbandry was as important as agriculture in the Kingdom of Asturias. And aside from ecological reasons, some authors have suggested that the importance of cattle in the Christian North also has a political explanation. Since peasants were always worried about Muslim raiders, they intensified the production of those goods that could easily be taken to shelters. This explains the prominence of animal husbandry in the borderlands, although this argument is not very convincing to explain the prevalence of the activity in core Asturias or Cantabria, that were not threatened by Muslim raids. In any case, the economy of the Kingdom of Asturias contrasts sharply with the more open and market-oriented economy of the Emirate and Caliphate of Córdoba, as we will see in a few episodes. Verdict. In today's verdict, I want to discuss the importance of this period for the consolidation of both the Kingdom of Asturias and the Kingdom of Pamplona. With the colonization and foundation of fortified cities along the Duero River, from northern Portugal to Burgos, the Kingdom of Asturias ensured the protection of Galicia, Asturias, and Cantabria. Alfonso III managed to expand his kingdom and the Asturian church and network of monasteries to control lands with a good economic potential. Asturias was closer to regions more firmly controlled by Muslim communities than ever before. So at the same time, it was evident that there would be more conflicts and things wouldn't be as easy from then on. However, the power projection of the Kingdom of Asturias improved, and King Alfonso III became a prestigious monarch, whose support was sought by some of the Andalusian rebels. At the same time, the establishment of the Jimena dynasty sealed a firmer alliance between Christians, in this case Asturias and Pamplona, who collaborated more frequently against the Muslims. The results of the alliance were very positive, as a more united Christian North could more easily defend from Andalusi attacks and even conquer their territories, as in the case of the region of La Rioja. Together, the northern Christians could resist a threat that was still some decades ahead: the Umayyad resurgence under Caliph Abderrahman III, and later the campaigns of dictator Almanzor. And with that, the verdict ends. In the next episode, I will talk about the birth of Catalonia, with the establishment of the de facto independent Catalan counties under Wifredo the Hairy. To end this episode, let me remind you that the podcast has a website, thehistoryofspain.com, that has a fantastic store with merchandising, history books, travel guides, books and material to learn Spanish, and more. If you love the podcast, you may want to support it by becoming a Patreon or making a donation. But there are other non-financial ways to support the show, like reviewing the podcast or spreading the word. Please subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and more, and follow the social media accounts of the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Medium, because you will find exclusive content that I'm sure you will enjoy. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and thank you for listening.